Good morning, Colorado. You're listening to the Daily Sun Up with the Colorado Sun. It's Thursday, November 17th. Today, we're talking to Colorado Sun political reporter Jesse Paul about the recent elections, and particularly Colorado's 3rd congressional district, which has not been decided. We also touch on what pollsters got right and wrong. Before we begin, we'd like to thank our friends and sponsors at Xcel Energy. Xcel Energy can help you find ways to keep your home or business running smoothly while reducing energy use and saving you money. Find everyday tips for using less energy and simple ways to manage your energy budget at xcelenergy.com. Now, let's go back in time with some Colorado history. Hundreds of residents of northeastern Colorado gathered in the Sedgwick County town of Ovid on this day in 1926 as the Great Western Sugar Company dedicated a towering factory where workers refined beets into sugar. The 22nd and final beet sugar factory erected by all companies in Colorado, the Ovid Works, reflected the prosperity and power of Great Western. Beet sugar offered an economic lifeline to the state after the Panic of 1893 eviscerated the mining industry. No company proved more successful than Great Western, founded by investors including John Campion and Charles Betcher. In 1901, it opened a factory in Loveland, the first of 13 Great Western erected in northeastern Colorado over the next quarter century, along with 9 more in Montana, Nebraska, and Wyoming. The company contracted with thousands of beet growers in the South Platte River Valley and recruited laborers, including Germans, Japanese, Belgians, Hispanos, American Indians, and Mexicans, to cultivate the valuable but finicky crop. By the time the Ovid Works opened in 1926, sugar beets grew in nearly half of Colorado's counties. The state produced a quarter of all beets grown in the country and led the United States in beet sugar production. By the mid-1920s, the value of Colorado's sugar beets outpaced the state's gold, silver, copper, lead, and zinc mines combined. Beet sugar remained vital to Colorado's economy into the 1970s. Federal trade policies and competition from sweeteners like high-fructose corn syrup led to the closure of most factories. Ovid's impressive factory came down in 2016. Only Fort Morgan's works remain in operation, whose sweet odor during the annual sugar campaign offers a reminder of the economic juggernaut that once dominated towns across Colorado. Before we continue, the Colorado Sun invites you to attend Closing the Gap, a conversation with Colorado's Black community about home ownership. Join the virtual discussion to hear from expert panels about getting the Black community to a place where they have better access to home ownership. The event is free and will be streamed and recorded on December 1st from 5:30 to 6:45 p.m. Learn more at coloradosun.com/events. Next, our feature story.
Welcome back to the Daily Sun Up Podcast, Colorado. I'm Carol Wood, guiding you through today's conversation, and I'm grateful to be here with you. And today, we get to talk to the Colorado Sun's politics reporter, Jesse Paul. Hey, Jesse.
Hey.
So thanks for coming back. I know it's been a whirlwind couple weeks for you, and I'm hoping that today we can break down some of the election topics. And then I also, before we get too far, I want to mention to our listeners that later today, on the evening of November 17th, from 6 to 7 p.m., you are going to be breaking down the election with some other political reporters. Can you tell us about that first?
Yeah, I'm really excited about it. So a couple of some folks I really respect in Denver are going to join us. Caitlin Kim over from CPR and Marshall Zellinger from 9 News. Hopefully he doesn't have to be on air. And then Sandra Fish, my colleague here at The Sun, we're going to just chat about some of the things that we saw during the election and some big takeaways that we had. So it's exciting. Some of the folks that I, you know, really respect in this profession and were out on the campaign trail alongside me, you know, people who are really experienced in Colorado politics, I thought it'd be fun to get them together just to chat for our readers about what we saw and what we heard and what we think the future is going to look like.
Yeah, I think it's a great way to break it down. And I love listening to and watching those reporters also, as well as you and Fish. Folks can go to coloradosun.com/events and sign up for it. It is virtual and it's free. And if you sign up for it, you'll also get a link to it afterwards. So if you can't make it in front of a screen from 6 to 7, you'll get a link afterwards and can watch it on our YouTube channel. So with that being said, Jesse, one of the things I was curious about is that we've heard in this election season is ballot curing. And can you explain to us what ballot curing is and how you know, we're hearing more about it in relation to congressional district number 3.
Yeah, so the election's not quite over in one district in Colorado. That's Colorado's third congressional district. And that's because we're still waiting for ballots to be cured. And this happens every single election. People, you know, turn in a ballot without their signature on it. You got to sign your ballot. Or they turn in their ballot with a signature that doesn't match what's in the state's voter file. And so the ballots get flagged and the voters get notified and they get an 8-day period to do what's known as curing or fixing. It's just a fancy word for fixing. And basically what happens is you can like send a text message or, you know, sign an affidavit and the ballot gets read and counted from there. But if you don't cure the ballot, it doesn't get counted. And so there's tens of thousands of these things every election season. That happened. And every year, you know, candidates and campaigns go out and try and cure ballots. But it's really notable here because the third congressional district race is separated by only 1,100 votes. And between the cured ballots and the military and overseas ballots, which are going to be turned in here on Wednesday, we're speaking on Wednesday, there could be enough in there to actually switch the outcome of this race. So there's this mad dash in the third district to reach, you know, all these voters who had the signature discrepancies.
And for our listeners, that third congressional district in Colorado is between the incumbent candidate, Republican Lauren Boebert, and her challenger, Adam Frisch, the Democratic candidate. So how many more days, Jesse? Is it later this week? Was it Friday that you had mentioned?
Yeah. So Wednesday at 11:59 is the last time by which you can cure your ballot. So we did the story that's on the site about all the kind of frantic efforts to get voters to cure their ballots. People are knocking on voters' doors. They're calling them. They're texting them. You know, Lauren Boebert even called one person that we talked to today in Grand Junction. So that's all done by Wednesday at 11:59. So by the time you're listening to this, it's over. But by Friday, end of day Friday, is when the county clerks have to actually count the ballots. They have to be done by then. And we should know a winner. And, you know, that is pending potential recounts. But by Friday at, you know, midnight or whenever the results get posted, I think we should know who won this race for sure.
Really interesting. Any other pending races that we're waiting to hear final calls on in Colorado?
The only one, and this might be called by the time folks listen to it, is Proposition 125, which would be wine in grocery stores starting in March. When I just checked it, the yes votes were up 2 percentage points. I feel very confident that's going to pass, but that's the only one that hasn't really been called yet.
Okay, good. Well, thanks for that breakdown. Tell us a little bit about the makeup of the state house now, post-election.
Right. So by now, it's like no secret that this was a really devastating election year for Republicans. And on top of that, you know, Democrats just won all these seats. They weren't expecting to be victorious, but they just had a great election year. And, you know, their wins were such that they are going to hold on to the majority in state government until at least 2026. And that's because, you know, even though there's elections in 2024, they really can't lose their majorities in the Colorado House and Senate. And so, you know, this will be a really interesting next 4 years where Democrats have been kind of handed this blank check from Colorado voters and have an opportunity to essentially do whatever they want to. And they've been this massive mandate. These are pretty historic margins that they hold in the state house. And so it's going to be interesting to see how far they try and go.
For sure, it will be. And, you know, one of the things that I'm thinking about is you and our politics team hosted debates, you know, between Joe O'Dea and Senator Michael Bennett, and debates for the Secretary of State and debates for the state treasurer. And, you know, a lot of us on staff were at those and watching them virtually. And I don't think that anybody really anticipated that this year was going to be so much of a landslide for and such a huge win for the Democrats. The other thing that comes to mind is it seems like the leadership that the Democrats are looking toward for the next year or two is very diverse. Can you talk about that a little bit too?
Yeah, so Democrats at the Capitol are kind of using this big new majority and taking it seriously. And one of the things that they're doing, they've already done, is elect, we think probably for the first time ever, the top three leaders in the Colorado House are going to be women. And that's a pretty big deal. And even the caucus, it's dominated by women. The Capitol is dominated by women. And it's pretty unusual across state houses in the United States. And the caucuses, not only are they dominated by women, but there's, you know, just a lot of people from diverse backgrounds, geographically, you know, ethnically, racially. And Democrats are really, you know, excited about this. They're really leaning into it and trying to give, whether it's women or people of color, positions of power in the Capitol. And it'll be kind of interesting to see how that kind of sets the tone.
Yeah, it certainly will. And then one of the things we're also interested in, or that I'm interested in, is kind of what pollsters did and did not get right in this election season. And I think you wrote about that in Tuesday unaffiliated newsletter that you and the politics team publish. And, you know, there's things that we don't get right, or that we think are going to pass or not pass, and we're wrong about that. But in general, were there things that professional pollsters predicted that you noticed came out differently than expected?
Well, there were a lot of things that came out as the pollsters predicted, but maybe not as I expected. And this is a good mea culpa for journalists and myself personally. So, you know, in the third district race that we talked about at the top, for instance, there was an internal poll put out by a really respected pollster in Colorado, a Democratic pollster, Keating Research, that said that Adam Frisch was within 2 percentage points of Lauren Boebert in that race. And we really, it's a Republican +9 district. And so that sounded a little unbelievable to us. And we wrote a story kind of saying, you know, here's the poll says, here's what the data in the district says. Obviously, it turns out the poll was right. And so, you know, definitely interesting. Definitely give a lot of credit to Keating Research for getting that right in a district that's really tough to poll. Another pollster that did a good job was Global Strategy Group, another Democratic pollster. If anything, they were maybe a little too rosy on the Republican side. They definitely predicted the big wins by Democrats. And then one of the more interesting ones that everyone really thought was a pretty bad poll that ignored the results, you know, Democrats, Republicans alike, people in the political sphere, was a poll from CU, which, you know, called these major margins accurately for, you know, the governor's race and the U.S. Senate race, the Secretary of State's race. They got some of the down ballot stuff, some of the ballot questions wrong. They're pretty on point with some of the big ticket, top of ticket, major races in Colorado. So that was impressive. And then on the flip side, there was two Republican pollsters who got things very wrong. One was Trafalgar, which is a national pollster based in Atlanta that did some work for Heidi Ginnall's campaign, the Republican gubernatorial candidate. They got it very wrong in Colorado, whether it was in that campaign or in the Senate race. They thought those were going to be much closer, when in reality, they were big blowout losses for Republicans. And then the Terrence Group, which is actually a really well-respected Republican pollster that did some private work for candidates, but we got a hold of one of their polls in the attorney general's race and the Senate race. And this one was kind of early in the cycle, so before TV ads and a lot of campaign messaging, but it was very off. And so, you know, I think Republicans were expecting to not win everything in Colorado, for sure. But I think that their pollsters got it wrong. And so they were feeling bullish because they were listening to what their pollsters had to say. And in reality, like, as you mentioned, you know, people talked about a red wave. This was a bigger blue wave in Colorado than we saw in 2018. This was not what people were expecting to happen.
Right, right. This is really fascinating. And, you know, I imagine that this evening, when kind of for the post-election perspectives, that this is some of the stuff that might come up between, again, for our listeners, it'll be you and Sandra Fish, our Colorado Sun data journalist. It'll be Marshall Zellinger from 9 News and Caitlin Kim from Colorado Public Radio. So I'm looking forward to that conversation. Folks can sign up at coloradosun.com/events, free and virtual, and just listen to kind of a postmortem on this election season. And after that, Jesse, I hope that you get some downtime and get to enjoy Thanksgiving next week with your family.
Yeah, thanks so much. And happy Thanksgiving to everybody out there if I don't get to talk to them before then.
Great. Thanks, Jesse. Thanks for dropping by. And thanks also to everybody who helped produce this podcast, including our production partners, Pirate Audio. And have a wonderful day out there. And I sincerely hope that you can join us for the next Daily Sun Up.
Read more at coloradosun.com. Finally, here are a few stories that you should know about today. A growing community of Colorado parents who have adopted children diagnosed with developmental trauma are finding each other through word of mouth and social media. What was once believed to be an extremely rare diagnosis is far more common than families thought. The behaviors associated with the disorder include stealing, manipulation, resisting affection from parents, yet indiscriminately being affectionate with strangers, and obsession with fire. In the final day of the Colorado Sun's investigation on failed adoptions, we look at how a shortage of therapists who know how to treat reactive attachment disorder is likely contributing to a 13% failure rate of adoptions from the state foster care system. Emergency service providers seeking to replace their new ambulances in Colorado are waiting years instead of months as manufacturers grapple with supply chain challenges. And it is a national problem. The vehicle manufacturing slowdown during the pandemic continues to send shockwaves. The delays make it difficult to navigate budget changes and grant applications while aging fleets get older, risking breakdowns. And one Colorado emergency official said as aging ambulances are pushed into longer service, the costs to run and maintain the vehicles can double. More than a dozen Western Slope communities will draw a combined $40 million a year for affordable housing after voters overwhelmingly approved new taxes on short-term rentals. The properties have been the target of local politicians and voters since 2019, when stories of new homebuyers bumping out locals to rent to vacationers became the dominant narrative. Experts say it is too early to know if increased regulation and limitations, coupled with higher fees and taxes, will put the brakes on a short-term rental market that has steamrolled through Colorado's high country housing landscape. For more information on all these stories, visit our website, www.coloradosun.com. And don't forget to tune in again tomorrow. The Colorado Sun is nonpartisan and completely independent. We're always dedicated to telling the in-depth stories we need today more than ever. And the Sun is supported by readers and listeners like you. Right now, you can head to coloradosun.com and become a member, starting at $5 per month. And if you bump it up to $20 per month, you'll get access to our politics newsletter, The Unaffiliated, as well as our outdoors newsletter, The Outsider, and our new health and environment newsletter, The Temperature. All three exclusive newsletters delivered to your inbox every week.